warm personality that communicates a genuine concern for his clients. I had mailed him a copy of my journal so that he would be well acquainted with my case when we met. I found that this saves a lot of effort when I want to tell my story to someone for the first time. After introductions and a cup of his hot coffee, Mr. Ault suggested that we get down to business. I brought a blank cassette tape and tape recorder with me and asked him to document our session. After we set up the equipment and tested recording, I laid down on his workbench, a wooden construct which stands waist-high off the floor. It was comfortable enough. Mr. Ault then asked me to stare up at the ceiling where he had taped a card just inside my field of vision. On the card was written the word peace, and, after a minute or so of staring at it, my eyes were feeding little rivers of tears that ran down the sides of my face to the back of my neck. This technique evidently puts the subject into a low hypnotic state, making it that much easier for the hypnotherapist to deepen the trance later. Mr. Ault took me through a relaxation exercise that left my arms and legs feeling as if they were made of lead. My body seemed much heavier than usual, and I wondered if I would be able to move if I tried, but I didn't try. I didn't want to do anything that might upset the process. My purpose was to go into as deep a trance as possible, and I followed Mr. Ault's every suggestion in that regard. He then asked me to visualize a door, beyond which was a special room where I would be safe and secure. I couldn't seem to picture a room. The only thing I was able to see beyond the door was the color blue. At any rate, this blue space served as a place of safe refuge. An attempt to regress me to the night of April 15th didn't get very far. That was the night Catherine stayed overnight with me, and I felt at the time that we had been taken. I started feeling anxious and couldn't bring up any images from that evening. Mr. Ault then asked me to pick any other time I wanted to investigate and go there instead. I chose my grandparents' home in Oklahoma when I was a boy. At first, I had trouble picturing the interior of the house. I kept seeing the color blue. Slowly, after what seemed like several minutes, I saw the eyes. Big, black, almond-shaped eyes would rise out of the blue and stare at me briefly before fading away. The blue color did disappear eventually to reveal the living room in Oklahoma, where I had spent many of my happier childhood moments. I was viewing the scene as if I was detached from it, looking from up high and over someone's shoulder, when a group of little beings with big, dark eyes swarmed through the front door and into the room. There were grown-ups there, Happy, Billy, and my mother, trying to stand between them and me, but to no avail. Within a second or two, we were completely surrounded by these little people. The scene quickly faded to blue. After a while, I could see the eyes again. Slowly, complete faces began to appear. Several of them were bent over, staring down at me. If I tried to stare back to get a better look at the details of their features, the image would fade away again, leaving just the blue background color. However, I found that if I closed my eyes tightly, the image would return and I could get another quick glimpse. When I looked up into their faces, I began to get emotional. It felt as if they could look right through me. I felt helpless and began to cry. At this point, Mr. Ault asked me if I had found out what I wanted to know. I replied that I wasn't sure, that I had conscious memories of some sort of commotion at the front door, and that the hypnotherapy had only given me glimpses of faces. At this point, Mr. Ault ended the session and brought me up out of the trance. Although during much of the session I wondered if I was in fact hypnotized, the way that I felt afterwards left me no doubt. As I opened my eyes and started to move, my body was very slow to respond. My mind felt spaced out, like I was on some kind of hallucinogenic drug. Even my visual sense was distorted. I felt detached from what I was seeing, as if I was looking through the eyes of someone else or watching a movie. These effects soon dissipated, leaving me feeling fully rested and alert. Mr. Ault explained that this was the way people typically reported feeling after hypnosis. I asked if there was any way to tell if the images I reported were in fact long-forgotten memories or the result of what I had recently read on the subject. In other words, was this real or just my imagination? He replied that in those cases of regressive hypnosis where the subject was reporting false memories, the images were almost never accompanied by any extreme emotion. The fact that I had gotten agitated and even started crying was a good indication to him that something real was being re-experienced. Now that I've confirmed this is actually happening, I can still scarcely believe it. It seems too fantastic to be true. I've known deep down in my gut that it was true, but there is still a part of me that is going to have trouble believing it. Wow. I have another session with Mr. Ault scheduled for next Friday. I'm going to stop here and take one more break. When I come back, I'll tell you about what I have scheduled for my next podcast. Again, another number by Cusco, this one titled Andes. Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. Visit the website at mutinyradio.fm for a complete list of what's happening. While you're there, check out the other programs as well. There's no registration process, and you get free access to dozens of weekly podcasts, from comedy to news analysis to far-out stuff like Close Encounters with Chuck Weiss. It's all there at mutinyradio.fm. We also have a 40-seat performance space available for rent. So if you're a performer looking for a really cheap place to put on a show, contact our station director, Pam Benjamin, at Pam Sedai, that's PAMSEDAI, all one word, at hotmail.com. That about wraps it up for this edition of Close Encounters. If you'd like to comment about what you've heard, you can contact me through my website at abductedbyaliens.org. The next time we meet, I'll tell you about an aspect of the UFO phenomena that the ETs share with Majestic, the practice of real magic, the subject of which I'm something of an expert. Until then, look to the skies. We'll be right back.
And welcome to the Weekly Review with Roman. Today is April 29th, 2016. That was Prince with Fury. And I like the idea of continuing to play Prince for as long as possible. The Current, which is a wonderful radio station out of Minneapolis, they played all of Prince's catalog in alphabetical order, which was great. Because various parts during those 2 days when I would listen in, get to hear a chunk of songs and then listen in later on in the day, and Prince is still playing, and it's awesome to hear songs I'd never heard before as well as those I was familiar with, and that was just really awesome and also just a great way of bonding with people, since Prince clearly touched and influenced so many folks. And outside Green Apple Books here in San Francisco, they have dedicated a bench to Prince. They've painted it purple, and I very much look forward to checking it out. So, again, celebrating the life and all of the art that Prince created and shared with us, and feeling very fortunate that we are around to experience that. It's San Francisco. I don't know where else I would be. I guess I could be somewhere else, but that's where we are broadcasting from. We're here in the Mission on 21st in Florida. Yesterday was the 11th annual Poems Under the Dome at City Hall, which I had the privilege of reading at, and that was very cool. And it was my first time there. I'd been to City Hall before, but my first time at Poems Under the Dome. And Supervisor John Avalos had folks in his office ahead of time, which was really cool for this little, not quite party, but a bit of like a celebration, which was awesome. And they had, you know, some drinks and some food, and folks were there gathered, maybe 30 of us. And just to have his office open to people was really cool. And they had a couple folks perform some music, a couple people perform poetry, and John Avalos wrote read a poem. And I thought that was really very cool, because it felt very, I guess, what San Francisco is supposed to be or was, and to kind of experience that, to be in this room with some people I knew, some people I didn't, in City Hall, to be kind of celebrating and to feel very unified, I thought was really awesome. That was really cool. And the poetry reading itself was pretty rad, and it's great just to hear so many people speak and to share their words, and some really great... I wouldn't call it necessarily a performance. I mean, it was a performance. There's a great mic out in Oakland, the Queer Open Mic on Tuesdays at Perch, and they refer to the performances, they don't even call them performances, they're more called love shares, which I think is awesome. And it also puts like less pressure on people, and also just the recognition that when people come up to the mic, whatever they're doing, whether it be comedy or music or poetry or spoken word or dance or video, whatever someone wants to share, just even ideas, the idea that it's a love share and that people are sharing from their heart. And just feeling very grateful that those places and spaces exist, and how wonderful it would be if there are more of them. I often feel that way. There was a MAP, which was like the Mission Arts Project, and they had a, this is maybe a month ago, I can't keep track of time anymore. I really can't. I have no idea when things happen. I have some idea. Part of it, I think, living in the Bay Area where the seasons don't really change, so it's like, what time of year is it? I don't know. It's not snowing. It hasn't ever snowed, really. It's not super hot. I don't know what time of year it is. That's tricky. So that, I think that's part of it. And then also not necessarily working a Monday through Friday 9 to 5, and just working different days and different hours, not necessarily on a certain time clock. So I sometimes forget when things happen. Anyway, there's a, I want to say maybe a month ago, probably a little bit sooner than that, outside the Mission Library, they had an open mic, which is really cool, just out on the sidewalk. And I really love when there are performances outside, because that means that people who are just walking by, who aren't even there with the intention of listening or checking it out, end up hearing it. And I think just the serendipitousness of that is really cool. And how awesome if that would be if there are more of them around, more mics and more places for people to share. So I think that's great. I'm in a good mood today, which is great. And I'm not going to go into it too much, because why ruin the mystery, I guess. Of course, I have been feeling very frustrated and triggered by all of the anti-LGBT legislation that's been going on across the country, especially within North Carolina. And Michael Jordan has actually stepped up against Pat McCrory, which is good. My feelings about Michael Jordan, I was a kid in the Chicago suburbs and was a diehard Bulls fan. And then I learned recently, or within the last few years, again, time, I don't know, that he has invested in private prisons, and that makes me super sad. However, I was very grateful to hear that he is stepping up to Pat McCrory about the HB2 bill, which is ridiculous. And a lot of folks have been stepping up, which is great. That's one positive thing that has come from these these asinine laws and people in power who want to create laws and pass legislation that end up harming people who are oftentimes the ones who are most oppressed and hurt. And I've had my own experiences of being asked to leave bathrooms. I've had it happen to friends I've been with, and I've heard about it happen to a lot of people I know. And it's not fun. It's not cute. It's just a terrible thing. So for folks who haven't experienced it, imagine you're in a public place, you're at an establishment, you're a customer, you're giving them money, and you need to use the bathroom, and people, imagine like someone following you into, I was following into a stall once, which is really messed up, and this was before I transitioned. This is, someone followed me into the stall, and I had to be like, no, I belong here, and I kind of just gave them hell, and I'm glad I did, but it was not fun. And that, of course, is something that's very minor compared to what so many people go through. People are attacked. People have been beaten up just for going into the bathroom. And it's something that's so simple that it just kind of boggles my mind. There's a good meme I saw this morning that I almost shared. I hesitate to share things, even if I like them a lot on Facebook. I have a really weird thing with what I decide to share, what I don't decide to share, and then sometimes share things and regret it. Anyway, there was a meme that was pretty much like, it was a picture of, you can see a woman's face kind of peering out under a bathroom stall that was like, let me see if you have a penis or a vagina so I can make sure that you don't make me feel uncomfortable. And that's pretty much what it is. It's putting cis people's comfort, their idea of comfort, at the expense of trans folks or gender nonconforming or however folks not want to be labeled, but are labeled, because that's unfortunately the only language that we have for now until things change and evolve a bit. It's putting those other people's, their idea of what comfort is, even though it's based on a lot of propaganda and fear and untruths. And again, there have been more U.S. senators who have been arrested for sexual misconduct in bathrooms than trans people. So and of course I don't necessarily believe in prisons and jails, but if we're going to put people in jail, it should be these Congress people who are really problematic, and killer cops. So while we have the jails up, for sure, might as well at least put in the people who deserve to be there. So I feel conflicted about that, because again, I'd like to live in a world without prisons at all. However, it's one of my main arguments against it is that there are folks who are innocent who are in there. There are folks in there for non-violent offenses, and I'll get to a story about that, which is pretty cool. That sounded wrong. But it's the idea of like getting people out of prison who are in there for nonviolent offenses who shouldn't be in there at all. And then there are people who are running the country, running things, doing things, and they're not in jail at all. Dick Cheney's not in jail, so if he's not in jail, if Karl Rove isn't in jail, and someone who smoked a joint once is, then the whole institution is flawed, putting it mildly. So I guess that will lead into the first story, which I will pull up here. And there's a few, always is a strong word. I often like to have positive stories because this show depresses the hell out of me. I'm not going to lie. I've been doing this now for 2.5 years. It's a really depressing show to read the news, to force myself to read it, to speak it aloud and recognize what's happening. It depresses me. I'm not going to say it doesn't. And I'm also not necessarily going to stop doing it, because I think there's a certain something good can happen with being uncomfortable. Is I'd rather I could have my head in the sand and not know what's happening, or I can face it as best I can and recognize what's happening, share it, educate myself, and then at least have some idea of what's happening. So I feel like that's a positive thing. So the story I'm going to get to, when I find it, if I find it, well, it'll come up at some point. We're pretty casual here. And let's start off with this one instead, because this is also related, and I found it first. The story I was going to get to, which I will get to, is that Oregon, which has now legalized marijuana, they are looking to undo the sentencing for folks who are in prison for Oregon. I'm going to start off with that one instead of this other guy getting, because there's Dennis Hastert, who is like this, I'll start off with him. Dennis Hastert sentenced to 15 months and apologizes for sex abuse. So here's like this dude. He's not. Oh God, I can't even. I'm gonna do a very brief. I think the older I get, the more I realize what I like and what I don't like and what really offends me. And the thing that probably offends me the most are people in positions of power who are hypocrites, who cause a lot of harm. And, you know, I get we're all human, we're all imperfect. However, when you have the ability to pass laws that damage families and tear people apart, and you're a hypocrite about it, and you do a lot of evil things, that's like, I don't like the idea of having an enemy. But that is what makes my blood boil the most. That and like war profiteers and people who profit off of causing other people harm. That's, I think, the worst thing in the world. That goes beyond just making a mistake, as we're all human, we all make mistakes. However, continually doing really hurtful, heinous behavior, and then as well as somehow being a representative for the people is, that's like just goes above and beyond. So I'll read the first. This is from the New York Times, which is really super mainstream and very right-leaning for me, but it's about this D-bag going to jail. So we'll just start off with that. So J. Dennis Hastert, once among the nation's most powerful politicians, was sentenced on Wednesday to 15 months in prison for illegally structuring bank transactions in an effort to cover up his sexual abuse of young members of a wrestling team he coached decades ago. In a hearing that was by turns harrowing and revelatory, Mr. Hastert publicly admitted for the first time to abusing his athletes, was confronted in emotional address by one of the former wrestlers and the sister of another, and faced a long, scathing rebuke from the judge. Mr. Hastert, 74, who made an unlikely rise from a beloved small-town wrestling coach in Illinois to Speaker of the House in Washington, sat slouched in a wheelchair in a federal courtroom here as a judge announced that he was rejecting pleas for probation from Mr. Hastert's lawyers, as well as prosecutors' endorsement of a shorter prison stay. While the sentencing hearing was, technically, about a violation of banking rules and regulations, the proceedings focused squarely on the underlying reason for Mr. Hastert's puzzling bank withdrawals, his abuse of young wrestlers who had viewed him as a role model. The defendant is a serial child molester. By the way, trigger warning, I should do this before the show, because the news is like super triggering all the time. So, a bit late for that, but here we go. The defendant is a serial child molester, said Judge Thomas M. Durkin of Federal District Court, as Mr. Hastert sat impassively, often staring downward, hands crossed on his lap. He added, "Some actions can obliterate a lifetime of good works. Nothing is more stunning than having serial child molester and Speaker of the House in the same sentence." And that's America. Mr. Hastert was not charged with sexual abuse because statutes of limitation for acts in the 1960s and 70s have run out. The judge noted, pointedly, that punishment for such a conviction would have been far worse. Illegally structuring bank transactions to keep such abuse secret, the felony count to which Mr. Hastert pleaded guilty carried a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. Mr. Hastert, whose date to report to prison has yet to be set, was ordered to pay $250,000 in fines, never to contact his victims, and to receive sex offender treatment. If there is a public shaming of the defendant because of the conduct he's engaged in, so be it, Judge Durkin said. Mr. Hastert has had a series of illnesses since last year, including a stroke, a bloodstream infection, and a spinal infection, factors his lawyers and family members argued to be taken into account in the sentencing. They urged the judge to consider the entire arc of his life and career, including his years of public service. As Mr. Hastert prepared to address the judge, he used a walker to rise to his feet, but his voice was firm and clear. I'm not going to quote him. This is me, Roman Reimer. I'm not going to read what this... I need to find new words I find that aren't offensive, because I don't like calling people dicks, because that's an insult to dicks. And D-bags, I don't know. It seems somehow... Anyway, not a good human being. And that's also a qualifier. However, this guy... No. So I'll just get to the end of the article here and see if we can... All right. So after payments began around 2010, the federal authorities took notice of large unexplained withdrawals Mr. Hastert was making from his bank. When told that large withdrawals had to be reported, Mr. Hastert began drawing smaller sums, prosecutors say, to avoid notice. The wrestler sued Mr. Hastert this week, saying he still owed him $1.8 million of their agreed-to settlement. Before the hearing, a long list of supporters from Mr. Hastert's wife, Jean, to Tom DeLay, I remember him, the former House Majority Leader, had sent letters to Judge Durkin. "He doesn't deserve what he's going through," Mr. DeLay wrote. But for nearly 45 minutes on Wednesday, Judge Durkin held forth in a passionate, often contemptuous tone with little interruption. He said that Mr. Hastert had manipulated the FBI and the United States Attorney's Office, diverted their investigation, and knowingly tried to set up individual A actions that were intentional, thought out, and desperate. The judge spoke broadly about child sexual abuse and the lifelong damage it inflicts. Can you imagine the whispers, the finger-pointing, the sideways glances if you're a 14-year-old boy and you accuse the town hero of molesting you, he said. He dismissed the defense's arguments that Mr. Hastert was too old, frail, or ill to be properly taken care of in federal prison. And he ended with a blunt synopsis. This is a horrible case, a horrible set of circumstances, horrible for the defendant, horrible for the victims, horrible for our country, he said. I hope I never have to see a case like this again. Court adjourned. Oof. So again, you can read the full article in the New York Times. Again, not a paper I necessarily fully am on board with, but each reporter has their own view. So, and the authors of this article was Monica Davey, Julie Boseman, and Mitch Smith, and this came out yesterday. So, yeah, again, that's kind of a theme of the show, was people in positions of power doing really terrible things. And also the thing with, like, paying people off, it's money doesn't bring back people who have been hurt or murdered. And it's kind of disgusting to live in a country where that is something that people can turn to. So I'm looking now right now for the article about Oregon, so that might take some time as we get there, but I feel like it's kind of in the theme with just the theme of, like, who gets sent to prison and who doesn't. And again, here's this guy who people in positions of power, oftentimes people don't stand up to them and they can get away with a lot, including passing really bad legislation. So I think that's pretty sad. But it's good that at least he's now being held accountable for his actions, even though it's too little and too late, in my opinion. So what else has been happening here? Here we go. We found it. That's great. Good things happening all the time. So this is from the United Media Publishing, and you can find it at unitedmediapublishing.com. Oregon will pay reparations to individuals formerly convicted of marijuana-related crimes. Oh, this is from last year, but that's still good. So this is written by Priscilla Mason. State officials have announced that starting July 15th of last year, Oregon will begin issuing reparations payments to those previously convicted of marijuana-related crimes within the past decade. The decision comes hot on the heels of the marijuana legalization measure, which takes effect July 1st throughout Oregon. Carol Shapiro is the newly appointed coordinator for the Oregon Department of Marijuana Reparations, and he elaborated on how the system will work to get those affected by previous laws back on their feet. These were essentially incidents that should have never even been tried as crimes to begin with. Thousands of people have paid dearly over the years for laws which have criminalized a substance that is basically less dangerous than any over-the-counter painkiller. Individuals who have served prison time for drug offenses involving marijuana within the last 10 years will automatically be eligible for a refund of any fines and fees incurred as a result of those convictions, as well as compensation for pain and suffering endured from being incarcerated. These parties will also have their records automatically expunged. We are hoping that these actions will correct the injustices previously inflicted upon innocent citizens and help them go on with their lives. This news comes as a bittersweet relief to those who have faced serious consequences within the last 10 years for their involvement in marijuana growing operations. People such as Portland native Marcus Ford, who spent 2 years in prison in 1999 after his marijuana growing operation was discovered by police. What can I say? It's not like I'm going to get those years of my life back or get the job back that I lost at the time. I don't think the federal government is innocuous. I don't think that the federal government is aware of the scope of what people have to deal with when they are sent to jail for things as innocuous as marijuana. I didn't see my kids for 2 years. I spent an additional 4 years on probation. It literally made my life hell and caused my family so much stress and anguish. I am glad they are trying to make up for it, but basically, no amount of money is going to replenish what I lost when I got locked up for growing. It's a relief that they understand the error of their ways now, but keep in mind that a lot of us have paid the ultimate price in this pointless war. Oof. So, yeah, I've got nothing to add to that. I'm going to play some music. We'll be taking a break from Prince, but we'll be back with some more Prince before the end of the show for sure. I went to this punk rock karaoke thing again. What's time? It was within the last week, I think it's safe to say, and I heard some new songs I hadn't heard before, and I dig songs with a political message. So here's one by a band called Refused called New Noise. And then we'll be back with some more stories. We'll be right back. welcome back. That was refused.
I slept out here for 6 days. You know, we haven't went home. We haven't done.
And it's. I'm surprised I don't play more angry music on the show because I feel like that kind of goes in line with the spirit and the energy. And listening to the lyrics, it's pretty much the idea is a lot of what we're told to like listen to and just go along with is old, and old in the way not just old in the way that it's not really constructive and needs to be challenged, and we need to create new ways of being. So I totally dig that. So next up, there's been the hunger strike, which has been happening now for almost a week outside the Mission police station. I encourage folks to go by and check out and support. And this is on Valencia and 17th Street. Folks have been camped out there now for quite a while. And here are some interviews with folks who have been doing the hunger strike outside of the station.
We've slept out here for 6 days. So we haven't went home. We haven't done a part-time hunger strike. We've slept out here.
We're on 17th in Valencia, the Mission, San Francisco Police Department station, and we're having a hunger strike. This is day six. Basically, we come to the conclusion that, like we said, we exhausted every avenue.
The hunger strike seems to be gaining more momentum every single day, and it's necessary because the city is doing its best to ignore the issues surrounding police brutality, the misuse of police tactics, police violence, and of course we're out here fighting for justice for our brother Mario Woods. I'm encouraged by the energy of the men and the women, young folks who have come out here, and they're trying to take a stand for Mario and for others to make sure that this stuff stops. As like this, the hashtag that we have here, it stops today. Like, it has to stop. And if we do not do anything, it will continue.
So, good evening. I'm Captain Perea from Mission Station. Tonight is our community meeting. It's from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, okay? The room that we have has a capacity for the fire department of 49 people. So we are going to count the number of people that come in. If you'd like to come into the meeting, you can line up against this these barricades here. Once we meet the capacity, we will keep track of who exits. If somebody exits, then another person come in. If three people exit, then three more people can come in. Okay? Thank you very much. So if you'd like to line up, it's to the right here. Okay?
Mic check. The hunger strikers have asked no one to go in until they're back up in front and they get in. So please wait.
Okay, good evening. I'm Captain Perea. I'm the commanding officer here at Mission Station. This is our community meeting that we have the last Tuesday of every month. It's 6 o'clock and we go to 7. So, the way that these are normally run is we give information about things that are going on in the district, and then we save the majority of the time for questions. So, this month, most recently, we had a community resource fair at Garfield Park. That was
Captain Barrett,
April 22nd.
We have a request as a community. You cannot fit everyone that's outside into this room. There are a number of people standing outside that should be in this room to listen to this meeting, to have a conversation with you. Because that's the case, our demand is that you host this meeting outside with the community. We have a megaphone for you, but you are more than welcome to come speak with us out there. We can have a conversation.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Will that request be met?
Okay, questions are at the end.
This is not a question, this is a demand.
Okay. Well, we'll save demands for the end, too.
Great. I'd like everyone to stand up, and we're about to fire chief, sir. So what do we want?
Fire chief, sir! Fire chief, sir! Fire chief, sir! Fire chief, sir!
I might have everyone's attention. The purpose of this meeting is to address concerns from the community.
Community has concerns. Community has concerns.
We need the
community needs to hear you, and that's why you need to go outside.
Sorry, folks.
We're humbly asking you to go outside.
Why is that? Lieutenant, you're doing it again. Please explain.
Sir, you're not coming in.
Why?
I don't have to.
Yes, you do.
No, I do not.
Yes, you do. You're violating your civil rights.
Cool. Exhale. You're not coming in.
Really? Are you recording this? So you're preventing the community from coming into a public space?
Yes, I am.
For what reason?
I don't have to give you a reason.
You don't have to give me a reason?
Correct.
So when you killed and shoot black and brown people, what reason did you have then? You didn't have to have a reason then either?
The community, majority of the community is outside, which cannot be let inside. So all we did was demand and request that the meeting be held outside instead of in this small room where there's other people who need to be in that room. So instead of meeting our demands, he storms out of the room and decides to not have his mandatory meeting.
Brother, I'm sorry you have to wear that badge and also do what you do. It's disappointing, because I know you want to stand with us. Oh, you don't want to stand with us. You're complacent to the fact that black and brown people are getting killed.
Yeah, let it.
They're violating our constitutional rights to peacefully assemble in a public space.
Why are we out here fighting?
We're fighting because we want Chief Sir to resign or be fired. And the reason we want that is because there's blood on his hands. There's been injustices in this city. Black and brown people getting killed indiscriminately with immunity. And we're tired of it. And I'm on day 7 on a hunger strike, and they got my blood pressure through the roof. So I hope you see this. I hope you share. Because I will stay out here as long as it takes. Amilcar Perez Lopez, Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, Luis Congora.
Brother was shot that many times. Wow. That's fucking crazy. Think about that. Amilcar Perez Lopez, we ain't forgot about you, young brother. Shot 6 times in the back and they tried to fucking say he shot himself. Amilcar Perez Lopez! Kenneth Harding Jr. Give it up. Kenneth Harding Jr. Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Kenneth Harding Jr. Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Come on.
Kenneth Harding Jr.
Alex Nieto. Come on.
Alex
Nieto. Come on. Never forget this brother was wearing a San Francisco 49er jacket in the middle of the Super Bowl, and they want to say that he was a North End. We can never forget that he was shot 23 times by 2 officers, and then 2 more rolled up and shot more times.
Not everybody gets to see somebody that they know be killed. It was painful. It was extremely painful. I'm saying, like, watching somebody that you've had conversation with, somebody that you've hoped and you've prayed for something better, somebody that you knew where they came from and you knew what they had to conquer in order to try to do something different, and then you see them get gunned down in the street. for no reason whatsoever. That was so painful, man. And like, you don't recover from stuff like that.
And welcome back. So this was some video footage that was taken outside the Mission police station. And again, there are folks there who are on a hunger strike to demand that Police Chief Greg Suhr resign or be fired. You can also contact the mayor's office. You can tweet. I've tried calling the number. No one answers. So I think tweeting is another way you can do that. It's at Mayor Ed Lee. So folks can contact the mayor that way. And again, I will just confirm the address. It's Twitter is at Mayor Ed Lee, MayorEdLee. Demand that Chief Suhr be fired. If he's listening, that would be, if Ed Lee is listening and wants to listen to the people and realize that the majority of the people would like this police chief fired, that would be great for him to act on that. I'm not holding my breath. But more pressure definitely needs to be put on the folks in positions of power who do have some sway. So this goes to, this is connected, of course. This is from Countercurrent News, and this article came out, this was earlier in the year, and this is a police union targets whistleblower cop who exposed racism in department, and this is from February. A whistleblower in the San Francisco Police Department has been targeted by her police union for publicly calling out the department for what she describes as a pattern of racism. She says now she fears for her safety from other cops while on patrol. Sergeant Yolanda Williams was one of two African American police officers who were mentioned by name in a series of racist text messages that were sent by a group of fellow police officers. Those text messages emerged last year in court filings related to departmental racism. Williams is one of the only police officers to ever participate in the Blue Ribbon Panel on Police Bias. That panel was formed by District Attorney George Gascon after a number of incidents with the San Francisco Police Department proved they had a serious problem with racism on their force. Williams has also headed an organization called Officers for Justice, which seeks to out dirty cops and those with overt biases that prevent them from impartially doing their jobs. But Williams says these activities have made her the target of other officers and the San Francisco Police Officers Association. The SFPO claims there is no systemic bias among police ranks. They've even called out Williams for claiming otherwise, pointing to her by name. On January 20th, the SFPO wrote a letter that was directly addressed to Williams, which they sent to all officers who are members of the union. President Martin Halloran said in the letter, "Don't like some of the comments William had made in front of Gascon's Blue Ribbon panel. The POA is disturbed by some of your comments and accusations. For example, you claim that racism is widespread within our department," the letter stated. "The POA disagrees. While a handful of officers engaged in racist and homophobic text messaging, they were condemned for doing so by the POA and by me personally, there is no evidence that racism is widespread throughout the department." On January 14th, Williams had testified that she had witnessed firsthand fellow officers using racial bias in their policing. She had said this is a widespread problem.
Coming up in 10 minutes, it's the House of Pride show with Tweeka Turner and co-guests Kim Sims, LP Vargas. And many more surprises. Stay tuned.